afternoon. I'm looking forward to this session, but also to seeing you all at the Capital Centre this week, reminding you that your tutors should have told you where to go this week in place of your seminar, up to somewhere called Capital Centre, which some of you will know is in Millburn House. And what will happen there is we'll have a practical workshop exploring this play. So you can think of this lecture as part one, if you like, and the workshop as part two. And that they replace, and this is the third year in which they have replaced traditional lectures and seminars. And don't worry if that scares you at all coming up for a practical workshop. It will be practical, but it won't mean that you have to do lots of acting or anything, so don't freak out. I look forward to seeing you there, so because I'm running the workshops as well. Today's a slightly unusual lecture in that it'll include bits of performance, as will become apparent as part, but it's probably become apparent already to you. So therefore, can you make sure you make sure your mobiles are up to you? I'm going to start now. Given the existence, as uttered forth in the public works of Puncher and Whatman, of a personal god, qua, 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 with a white beard, qua, 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 outside time, without extension, whom from the house of divine Apavia, divine Athambia, divine Aphasia, loves us dearly, with some exceptions, for reasons unknown, but time will tell, and suffers like the divine Miranda, with those order and reasons unknown. Like a lecturer spouting nonsense, Beckett's absurdist masterpiece alienated and intrigued 1950s audiences in the same way as that. Infamously, a play in which nothing happens twice, Beckett's text had been written in French and was performed in 1953 at the Théâtre de Babylone, Paris, before several international productions, including Peter Hall's 1955 show at the Arts Theatre London and Herbert Blau's 1957 production performed at San Quentin Prison. As I speak, the play is back in London's West End with Ian McKellen reprising his role as Estragon, this time opposite not Patrick Stewart, but Roger Rees as Vladimir. Those of you who know the play will have already realised that the text I opened with is the centrepiece of Act One, Lucky's tirade in response to the command, think pig. In a few minutes, I'll introduce the first of our rehearsed readings, which will show this tirade in its theatrical context. But first, I wanted to introduce Beckett's text in the context of his debts and legacies. Samuel Beckett, awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 69, had a huge influence on a generation of artists in a diverse cross-section of literatures. For Salman Rushdie, writing an introduction to Beckett's work, he considers the linguistic complexity of Beckett's writing process. So here's Rushdie on Beckett. A man speaking English beautifully chooses to speak in French, which he speaks with greater difficulty, so that he is obliged to choose his words carefully, forced to give up fluency and to find the hard words that come with difficulty. And then after all that finding, he puts it all back into English, a new English, containing all the difficulty of the French, of the coining of thought in a second language, a new English with the power to change English forever. And that, if you're not aware of the process, is obviously referring to the fact that Beckett chose to write in French, although he was Irish, hence the first being performed in Paris. Harold Pinter, by contrast, remarks upon the authorial simplicity of Beckett's writing. Pinter writes, "The further he goes, the more good it does me. I don't want philosophies, tracts, dogmas, creeds, ways out, truths, answers, nothing from the bargain basement. He is the most courageous writer going, and the more he grinds my nose in the shit, the more I am grateful to him." For Peter Brook, in his 1968 The Empty Space, he remarks that the following qualities could be found in Beckett's theatrical work. Four things: small means, intense work, rigorous discipline, an absolute precision. You can find that in Brooks' chapter, The Holy Theatre, in his book, The Empty Space. Beckett's own influences demonstrate a significant range and depth, partially informed by his early academic work, which focused on French and Italian. And it's always worthwhile to consider both Proust and Dante in relation to his work. However, he was also profoundly shaped by modern voices, not only James Joyce, with whom he worked, but also W.B. Yeats and T.S. Eliot. These debts and legacies paved the way for his unique cultural position as simultaneously the last modernist, to use Anthony Cronin's phrase, as well as the first postmodern dramatist via post-structuralist and deconstructionist schools of thought. Although the idea would have repulsed Beckett, he has become one of the most written about writers, most notably in relation to the theories of Derrida, Deleuze, and Badiou. However, others have positioned Beckett in connection to an earlier philosophical tradition, the work of Descartes, Schopenhauer, and Kierkegaard. For Martin Esslin, Beckett was first and foremost an absurdist. And I'm reading here from Theatre of the Absurd, Martin Esslin's book, which is very useful, very approachable on the absurdist playwrights. So for Esslin, this is what it means to be an absurdist, or what Theatre of the Absurd, what he means by this phrase. Absurd literally means out of harmony in a musical context, hence its dictionary definition, out of harmony with reason or propriety, incongruous, unreasonable, illogical. In common usage, absurd may mean simply ridiculous, but that is not the sense in which Camus uses the word, and in which it is used when we speak of the theatre of the absurd. In an essay on Kafka, Ionescu defined his understanding of the term as follows. Absurd is that which is devoid of purpose, cut off from his religious, metaphysical, and transcendental roots. Man is lost. All his actions become senseless, absurd, useless. This sense of metaphysical anguish, of the absurdity of the human condition, is, broadly speaking, the theme of the plays of Beckett, Adamov, Ionescu, Genet, and other writers discussed in this book. So that's Esslin's statement on the absurd. In connection to specifically the play we're looking at this afternoon, in relation to Godot, Esslin says this. When Alan Schneidner, who was to direct the first American production of Waiting for Godot, asked Beckett who or what was meant by Godot, he received the answer, "If I knew, I would have said so in the play." This is a salutary warning to anybody who approaches Beckett's plays with the intention of discovering the key to their understanding, of demonstrating in exact and definite terms what they mean. Such an undertaking might perhaps be justified in tackling the works of an author who had started from a clear-cut philosophical or moral conception and had then proceeded to translate it into the concrete terms of plot and character. But even in such a case, the chances are that the final product, if it turned out to be a genuine work of creative imagination, would transcend the author's original intentions and present itself as a far richer, more complex, and open to a multitude of additional interpretations. For Beckett himself has pointed out in his essay, Joyce's Work in Progress, the form, structure, and mood of an artistic statement cannot be separated from its meaning. Its conceptual content, simply because the work of art is its whole meaning. What it is said is indisputably linked with the manner in which it is said. So Esslin, that's a very useful statement, so I want to read it out in its entirety. It's referring to an essay that the young scholar, translator Beckett wrote about Joyce, in which he said, here, form is content, content, form. I think that's very useful. And that obviously relates to the fact that Beckett is refusing to tell you who Godot is, because it is a play about waiting, as opposed to a play about Godot. So with this in mind, I'd like to introduce the first performance this afternoon. I should point out that the student ensemble are using the convention of script in hand rehearsed reading, so you shouldn't approach this work as a finished product. Rather, it is a stimulus for thinking about Beckett's performance text in space and time. This is one of about four extracts we'll show of about 5 minutes in length. I'm sure you'll be very kind and supportive. So, could we move into position, please? Don't move. This moment, and Watteau's insistence that no one should move, has significance in terms of both the form and content of the play. One of the reasons I've been asked to give this lecture by Jeremy is because I've recently directed some Beckett at Rough Theatre 2 and Ohio Impromptu at Oxford Playhouse. And although Beckett wrote these plays later than Godot, in rehearsal we found that they were also about this idea of not moving or not being able to move. So we called the double bill stasis. And I think that's a really useful thing across the dramatic output. Stasis and silence. And silence is something we'll think about in the workshops you do at Capital. And stasis and silence as dramatic conventions rather than simply the absence of something. Beckett's tableau vivant operate in much the same way as Francis Bacon's screaming heads or Harold Pinter's infamous pauses. Beckett holds you, the audience, in a single, unified, static setting and, to quote Peter Brook again, burns the image into your brain. You will know, as we return to this scene, that Pozzo finds it impossible to depart. Beckett attended rehearsals for the 1953 Waiting for Godot in Paris and the London productions of his plays in the late 50s and early 60s, but it was not until 1967 that he formally accepted the role of director on a production of his Endgame in Berlin. He would go on to direct Godot in 1975, as well as many of his shorter works for the stage. As the Beckett scholar Stan Gontarski reminds us, here I quote, as he approached the Schiller Endspiel, Beckett rethought his play on paper in a Reggie book, a meticulous director's notebook. Such notes would thenceforth characterize his approach to directing, as they had his approach to writing, and in directing, and directing in turn would liberate a repressed voice. I wanted to put that up there because it's quite interesting. First of all, if we think back to the Rushdie, this idea of deliberately writing in a language other than your own, and then secondly, deliberately entering a practical space where language is in flux, like a theatrical rehearsal room. I think that's quite important when thinking about Beckett. So this interplay of repression and release is also central to the performance style required for his plays. Many practitioners talk about the intense liberation they experience within the absurd limitations of his stage directions. I mean, some of you who know his other plays will know that sometimes he asks people to be buried up to their waist in sand, or even up to their neck in sand, or just have their head sticking out of an urn. So Godot, in many ways, as his first play, is his least absurd. And when he came to direct it in 1975, he found it just, there's too much going on. He found it messy and there was too much action and he had to chisel away and make it more formal. So if you think of Godot as a kind of weird play in which nothing happens, look at the rest of his plays. And Godot is the most mainstream in that sense. This meticulous quality informs the structural symmetry of the play. So he's obsessed with kind of structural symmetry. Clearly apparent when we witness Pozzo and Lucky appear once more in Act 2, but with notable contrasts and changes. Beckett's early biography is haunted by the experience of failure. He rejected the Academy, in his case Trinity College Dublin and the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. He composed poetry. He translated. He wrote prose, but with limited recognition. It took years and years and years to get published. He worked with James Joyce, It is said that Joyce read out extracts of Finnegan's Wake, which Beckett transcribed personally. He theorised Proust. Beckett wrote a thesis on Proust. He buried his father in Ireland. He finally published, this is the 30s I'm talking about, he finally published his most conventional novel, Murphy. And then war broke out. Leaving Paris in June 1940, he returned in October and joined La Résistance the following year with his life partner, Suzanne. And I think that is something that is sometimes forgotten by those who would have Beckett as the navel-gazing pessimist. He fought in the French resistance, and of his resistance cell of 80, only 20, which included him, Suzanne, and 18 other people, only 20 got out with their lives, because it was a resistance cell that had been infiltrated by the Nazis, and Beckett had to live in rural France until Paris was liberated, on the run, sometimes sleeping in ditches and eating carrots. So one of the things he'd written, therefore, is given that list of things that happened to him in the 30s, he'd also written this: to be an artist is to fail, as no other dare fail. Failure is his world. This was written as a dialogue with George Dutuit, excuse my French translation, accent, around the same time as Godot, so that sort of very late 40s into the early 50s. He's writing that dialogue about art, which is probably just three dialogues, Waiting for Godot, and his great prose trilogy, Malone Dies in the Unnameable. And Beckett said he wrote Waiting for Godot for a break from that big writing project, which was his prose trilogy. So you're not just looking at a first play, you're also looking at something that was written to pass the time, to as an alleviation. We can put this Rickettian statement of artistic identity, this idea of failure, against the four perfectly formed sentences from his 1983 prose piece, Worstwood Ho. Worstwood Ho, not Westwood Ho. These are the four sentences. You've probably heard this before. No matter. Try again. Fail again. Fail better. To return to Beckett's articulation of his own inexpressiveness in the immediate post-war period, we can historicise this idea within the breakdown of order and creation after a period of chaos and destruction. An Irishman having studied in France, Germany and Italy, Beckett would have experienced the events and fragmentations of the Second World War in a particularly and peculiarly complex and painful way. Yet his post-war refusal to express is fundamentally different to, say, Adorno's after Auschwitz, to write a poem would be barbaric. Beckett is not simply referring to a state of rejection or refusal. John Calder, his publisher, says this: Beckett, however, is doing more than voice his dissatisfaction of artists with their own limitations. Art for him is not part of life, a human activity, a means of earning a living, of self-expression. It is rather the act of creation itself, the making of the world, and the making of a painting differ only in scale. It's John Calder. At this point, I'd like to return to Harold Pinter, who insisted that Beckett's work did this. Beckett, the thing I was reading earlier about when he grinds your nose in the shit, finishes like this: he leaves no stone unturned and no maggot lonely. He brings forth a body of beauty. His work is beautiful. This formal beauty is something that came to Beckett late in life as part of an aesthetic journey that Stan Gontarski has subsequently called the intent of undoing. The intent of undoing. Should bear in mind that most of the famous Beckett pieces that we know and study are written in his middle age or when he's quite elderly, not at the start of his career. Structure, scale, beauty and shape were essential to Beckett's writing. As Beckett wrote to Harold Hobson in 56, "I'm interested in the shape of ideas, even if I do not believe them." There is a wonderful sentence in Augustine. I wish I could remember the Latin. It is even finer in Latin than it is in English. "Do not despair. One of the thieves was saved. Do not presume. One of the thieves was damned." That sentence has a wonderful shape. It is the shape that matters. And elsewhere Beckett wrote, "To find a form to shape the chaos, or shape the mess, to find a form that shapes the mess, that is the job of the artist now." So you might want to put that against some of the stuff I've been saying about World War II. Anyway, it's interesting that sentence, which particularly is in relation to Godot. "Do not despair, one of the thieves was saved. Do not presume, one of the thieves." And elsewhere, and finally, he was quoted as saying this: "Critics have said Godot's structure," sorry, he was quoted as saying this: "One act would have been too little, and three acts would have been too much," about Godot. "One act would have been too little, and three acts would have been too much." Important structural point as well. So with this in mind, we're going to start drawing the lecture to a close with some more performance work. What I've decided to do is show you the end of both acts, one after another, so you can see this idea of balance and shape, and see what echoes, patterns, and rhythms exist across both pieces. So I'm going to sum up, because, as I said, this is part one of two-part experience here this week. So part two is the workshop, and I've deliberately left things out of this lecture that will be said or experienced in the practical work at Capitol. So to sum up, with some closing words from the Nobel presentation in Beckett's honour, which the author did not intend, in line with his policy to never publicly explain or discuss his work. So the things I've been reading out are actually from letters, he'd never publicly explain. "Speaking of happy days, but generalising to all of Beckett's work, the Swedish Academy, the Nobel, stated the following: out of the suffocating silence, however, there still rises the head, the voice crying in the wilderness, man's indomitable need to speak out, to seek out his fellow men right to the end, speak to his peers, and find companionship, and find in companionship his solace." Sorry. Read that once more, because I made two mistakes. "Out of the suffocating silence, however, there still rises the head, the voice crying in the wilderness, man's indomitable need to seek out his fellow men right to the end, speak to his peers, and find in companionship his solace." That was the reason they wanted to give him this award, while he was apparently hiding out in Tunisia, because he couldn't bear the attentions of the world's media.